Lee Tyndall Snow is a CDC CSTE Applied Epidemiology Fellow. Yay. She's working, bless you, there's some pollen in the room already, perhaps. You should have done that a little earlier. No, I'm just kidding. She's working in the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services currently. She received her Bachelor's of Science in Biology and Linguistics from the North Carolina Chapel Hill University, and she has a master's degree in public health in global environmental health from Emory University. She previously worked at CDC studying risk factors of sporadic cryptosporidiosis, and her current subject area is waterborne disease epidemiology of all topics, from algal blooms, blue-green algae variety, to zoonotic parasites and the impacts of climate change on waterborne diseases. And the title of her presentation this morning is The Distribution and Determinants of Waterborne Diseases in Michigan Subpopulations. So please help welcome Lee.
Thank you. Well, thank you guys all for being here, and thank you, Michael, for the introduction. I think I'm feeling the effects of pollen, so please bear with me today. So first I'm going to give an overview of climate change and waterborne disease, since we haven't really talked about that much today, and then talk a little bit about vulnerability. I'll spend most of the time talking about a project that I did for MDHHS to assess vulnerability to waterborne diseases, and then I'll talk about a little bit about what comes next. So we've heard this session a little bit about climate change and injury and pollen. So I'm going to give a little overview of how climate change could affect your health in regards to waterborne diseases. This is an infographic from APHA showing the pathway from changes in extreme weather to waterborne disease. So extreme weather and extreme precipitation events we know are expected to increase in the coming years, and that will lead to increased flooding and storms. These floods and storms will lead to more water contamination events, which eventually leads to a higher incidence of waterborne illness. So some of the key findings from the U.S. Global Change Research Program's Climate and Health Assessment are that water temperature increases will lead to certain geographic range and extended growth seasons of cyanobacteria, that's that blue-green algae, and certain species of Vibrio bacteria. And also, more extreme precipitation events will increase the number of contamination of recreational water and drinking water sources, which will also increase the introduction of pathogens. I've highlighted on the graph there. According to Carriero et al., 51% of waterborne outbreaks between 1948 and 1994 followed extreme precipitation events. So this is a very real thing. More extreme weather and flooding will increase the risk of drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater treatment infrastructure failure, particularly in areas with aging infrastructure. And all of these changes could result in an increase in human exposure to waterborne pathogens and algal toxins in a variety of ways. So based on estimates from the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessment Center, Michigan expects to see a 3 to 6% increase in average precipitation between now and the latter half of the century. However, changes in averages of total precipitation is only part of the picture. So the number of extreme precipitation days, that is, days with at least 1 inch of rain, has increased overall in Michigan since the mid-20th century, but there is a wide variability in that increase across the state. So there are clear trends projecting more heavy precipitation in the future, and the majority of models for the Great Lakes and for Michigan project an increase in extreme precipitation days of 10 to 36%. The rate of change increases as you go north, and you can see a wide geographic variation across the state in this map of the Midwest. As I mentioned previously, not all changes are due strictly to rainfall. Southeast Michigan is our area of highest population density, It also has older infrastructure and more impervious surfaces. That's where Detroit is and the surrounding area. Therefore, that area is expected to see higher amounts of flooding and poor water quality in the next 25 to 50 years. And as I mentioned earlier, this can lead to greater exposure and therefore incidence of waterborne disease, making this our most vulnerable area. So there are two aspects to consider when assessing vulnerability, and I think this is part of the BRACE framework. The first is environmental exposure. What areas are in a floodplain? Is there any karst topography in the area, and where do the most extreme precipitation events occur? And the second aspect is population sensitivity, so how many people over the age of 65 live in the area, how many children are there, how many sick people. And the project I'm going to describe to you now is an attempt to assess population sensitivity to waterborne diseases. Who gets sick and what determines whether or not they get sick? To assess population sensitivity, we pulled 5 years of data from the Michigan Inpatient Database. That's a database that covers all hospitalizations at Michigan acute care hospitals, regardless of insurance status. And we queried primary, secondary, and tertiary diagnosis fields for 5 ICD-9 CM codes that represent 4 diseases that are classified as primarily waterborne by CDC. And these diseases are cryptosporidiosis, giardiasis, Legionnaire's disease, and nontuberculosis mycobacterium infection, which I will call NTM for short, because that's a mouthful. So to analyze this data statistically, we calculated incidence rates and descriptive frequencies and relative risk of waterborne disease for several comorbid conditions. We used a chi-square test for significance to test the significance of the risk ratios. So first, I just want to give a little bit of comparison. So this is the these 4 graphs of each of the 4 diseases that we looked at shows the difference between hospitalized cases, so that's the data that I looked at in red, and our general surveillance data for the state shown in blue. So the surveillance data captures a lot more, particularly of those with more outpatient visits like cryptosporidiosis and giardiasis. So hospitalizations for those two only represent a very small amount of overall cases in Michigan. But for Legionnaires, a more serious disease, many people who are infected do get hospitalized, so it's a little more even. And NTM is not reportable in Michigan, so there's really no surveillance data for comparison. So of the over 7 million total hospitalizations from 2009 to 2013, only 0.3% had a waterborne disease diagnosis. And of these hospitalizations, 43% had a waterborne disease diagnosis as the primary diagnosis, or principal diagnosis, if you will. And 35% had the waterborne disease as a secondary diagnosis, and 21% had a waterborne disease as a tertiary diagnosis. So this graph shows the distribution of the 2,139 waterborne disease hospitalizations by year for the 4 diseases that we looked at. Here's on the x-axis, and number of hospitalizations is on the y. And as you can see, there are considerably more NTM and Legionnaires' disease hospitalizations than crypto or giardia, partly due to the difference in severity of those diseases. So we looked at demographics for sex, race, and age. And when broken down by sex, males, which is shown on the right, had a higher proportion of hospitalizations, which is in red, compared to the general population of Michigan, shown in blue. And when we broke this out over the 4 diseases, this relationship held. The difference between the proportion of males and females being hospitalized was particularly pronounced for Legionnaires' disease, which is expected given that men are at higher risk of Legionnaires than women. So when we looked at the proportion of hospitalizations across race in comparison to the general Michigan population, African Americans were overrepresented in the hospitalization data, which is also a little bit expected. The numbers in white on the top of the bars there show the number of cases. And these proportions held when we looked at all of the diseases separately as well. So this graph shows the distribution of rates across 10-year age group for each disease. And the age groups are along the bottom of the axis. And the rate per 100,000 population is on the y-axis. So the orange line on the top represents rates for all waterborne disease hospitalizations. And cryptosporidiosis and DR diasis are in red and green, respectively, and Legionnaires and NTM are blue and purple. So rates for all of the diseases increase as the population ages, but crypto and Giardia also have a small peak in the 1 to 4 age range, which I think is mimicked in the general surveillance data for the country. So I mentioned earlier that about 43 of the hospitalizations had a waterborne disease diagnosis as their primary diagnosis. And so I wanted to look at what the primary diagnosis was for the other 56.8% of the waterborne disease hospitalizations. So talking about now that part in solid blue. And so that came down to 1,193 hospitalizations. And so for those, the top principal diagnoses were septicemia, which was by far the most, HIV infection, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, respiratory failure, and pneumonia. So for all of the waterborne disease hospitalizations, so we're back to the whole pie now. We wanted to see what the major comorbidities were. So these top five were hypertension, tobacco use, hyperlipidemia, hyperpotassemia, and acute kidney failure. And we wanted to assess the relationships between waterborne disease hospitalizations and these other diagnoses, so we calculated some relative risks. These don't indicate causality, they're just associations, but hypertension and hyperlipidemia were not significantly associated with waterborne disease. These were quite common comorbidities diagnosed across all of the hospitalizations. But tobacco use, hyperpotassemia, acute kidney failure, septicemia, HIV, and COPD did have statistically significant associations. HIV's was the largest association. So we wanted to look into that to see if that relationship was the same for all diseases or if there was just one really strong relationship that was inflating the overall results. And surprisingly, with our data, there was a significant relationship between HIV and all four waterborne diseases. So HIV is a known risk factor for if cryptosporidiosis infection and non-tuberculosis mycobacteria infection, but the literature is ambivalent on the relationship between the other two, giardiasis and Legionnaires. So having all four be significant in our data was an interesting result. The study had several limitations. This is not representative of the entire population, as I showed you with the in comparison to the surveillance data before. So this is only hospitalized individuals. So this gives us the sickest of the sick, but it's not generalizable to the general population of Michigan. And there are also pretty low numbers of waterborne disease hospitalizations. So in conclusion, hospitalization data can be useful for identifying waterborne disease vulnerabilities. Disparities do exist between age, race, and gender groups, and certain diseases, such as HIV, do increase the risk of waterborne infection. So where to next? Once populations of interest are identified, it becomes possible to implement interventions in those populations to educate them and make them aware of the risks and what to do about them. And while not touched on much in this presentation, it's also important to identify the vulnerable environments. So where are the drinking water treatment plants that need an extra boost to be prepared for flooding? So there are researchers now who are looking at the relationships between waterborne disease and extreme precipitation all over the Midwest. I know of, specifically there have been some publications out of Wisconsin, and we're looking into doing some studies there too, or in Michigan as well, rather. And there are researchers, there are many ways to go from here, and there's a lot of work yet to be done. So I'd like to acknowledge my mentors and Lori Cameron, who's worked with me pretty closely during my fellowship, and Tom Largo, who gave me a lot of help with the database that I was working with. So.